Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Michael Mandel. Michael is professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School, York University in Toronto. He teaches international criminal law, constitutional law, and legal policies. Politics, legal politics. His marvelous book still sticks with me. He wrote it some years ago. It's a title I wish I thought of. He titled his book, How America Gets Away with Murder. Subtitle, Illegal Wars, Collateral Damage, and Crimes Against Humanity. All U.S. administrations prioritize those kind of things. Keeps Michael busy, keeps me busy, keeps other guests in this program busy. We got to fight back, and we do it all the time. Michael, welcome to the program. It's great having you back again.
Hi, Stephen. Very glad to be here.
I'm going to let you jump into whatever area or issue you want to go at first. And my God, there is so much going on in Canada, in America, globally. What's particularly on your mind?
Well, it's hard to know where to start. I mean, in Canada, we have this, right now we have a protest by the Aboriginal peoples trying to get some kind of, after many, many years, some kind of justice, some kind of respect for treaty rights and some kind of equality that they've been denied. I know that the situation is very similar to the United States, but right now there's a big protest movement, a desire that these disgraceful conditions that people live in the rich countries. I mean, you know, there's inequality within countries has grown enormously, just as the inequality between countries has grown enormously. And I think that, you know, if we look for the root of the problems of the violence that pervades this world, from Syria to Palestine, to Africa now, we see this enormous inequality, these obscenely rich people that we have in Canada, the United States, and the rich countries, even in the third world. It's unbelievable poverty, people who go without food, people who go without medicine. And this is, you know, kept in place by the barrel of a gun, basically. And so, you know, everywhere you look, you see, we used to say, one struggle, many fronts. And I think that inequality, I remember that Quincy Jones, when they said when the war in Afghanistan broke out, and they asked him, what's this war about? He says, there's too much fucking inequality in the world. That's what this war is about. And I agree with him.
Oh, absolutely, Michael. That and a whole lot more. And, of course, there's a war against ordinary people in Canada, in America, in, I would guess, in every single Western country, and too many of the Eastern ones, the ones in Eastern Europe, the so-called liberated Soviet satellites.
Right.
I mean, their economies are absolutely abysmal. Poverty is rampant. All kinds of social justice pain afflicts the great majority of people.
And they deliberately went about destroying those economies. They deliberately went, not only for their own exploitation, but just for the sake of destroying any model, any obstacle to profit-making. I mean, if you look at the wars in Yugoslavia, they were deliberately created by neocons who wanted to, obviously the businessmen wanted it in there, but they wanted to destroy these countries, make them economically dependent on the European powers and the American powers, and therefore make them politically dependent. And from that follows bloodshed, unbelievable bloodshed. People's standard of living is destroyed. Their cultures are destroyed. And the violence just follows. And then they say, well, it's ethnic hatreds, ethnic hatreds that didn't seem to express themselves until, you know, the shock doctrine, as my co-national Naomi Klein calls it, was put into practice.
Oh, absolutely. A crisis is a wonderful thing, the powers that be feel. You can do things during crisis times that you can't do other times. The mayor of my city, Rahm Emanuel, former White House chief of staff, I mean, he gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal some years ago when he was still at the White House. He called a crisis too great an opportunity to waste. You can't steal and plunder and do all these nasty things
right,
unless you really have a crisis to exploit. You convince people that something awful is going on, and the horrible policies that you're instituting are the ways to solve the problem. Of course, what it does is make things worse, and they created the problem in the first place. Oh, my goodness. Of course, there's a war. My brand-new book that came out a few weeks ago, Banker Occupation, it discusses waging war on humanity. That's exactly what the so-called fiscal cliff hoax is all about, destroying America's social contract. The same thing is going on in Canada, more virulent in America than Canada, but Stephen Harper, your lovely prime minister, really wants to race and catch up with America. If you guys don't stop him, he's just liable to do it. And the same stuff going on
Stephen
in Europe.
Stephen Harper comes out of this National Citizens Coalition, which was, you know, the extreme right, racist, xenophobic, Republican right. This was the Tea Party of Canada, and they used to oppose everything, every social program, unions, etc. That's where Stephen Harper came out. Their party, you know, it's ironic that they're the best friends of Israel, because their party, which was the so-called Reform Party, had more Nazis in it per capita than you could find in any other party, all the other parties put together. And so this guy, Stephen Harper, is dyed-in-the-wool Tea Partier. Everything he's doing is aimed at that. One of the things he's doing, of course, is supporting, I mean, they supported Israel more extremely than even ultimately the United States did. And it has nothing to do with loving Jews or with loving Israel. It has all to do with this right-wing agenda, this anti-Islamic agenda, and a warlike agenda. I think Israel is, Israel-Palestine is a, pretty good example, paradigm, or the proof of all the hypocrisy of the United States. When people talk about human rights and legality and support for self-determination against tyranny, they neglect an occupation that has gone on now for 45, going on 46 years. And, I know that the establishment of the State of Israel was highly controversial, but nevertheless, the legality of that is well established from 1949. But the 1967 occupation of all that Palestinian territory with millions of Palestinians under their control was condemned by every institution of international law. And so here we have military occupations going on for 45 years over millions of people, brazen, with no pretext of ever respecting the Security Council or the World Court or any of those people. And we have tens of thousands of people killed in that conflict, people killed every day. And this is bankrolled, underwritten by the United States, while it condemns the human rights violations of all the other countries in the world. The war in Syria, the war in Iran, the war in Syria is largely about protecting Israel in the Middle East and countering Iran. And the war in Iran is basically about, making sure that Israel keeps the Middle East safe for the United States. So all of these things, all of these, the claims to be defenders of human rights and to be fighting terrorism, and who's supporting terrorism. Israel is a terrorist state, and the United States is a terrorist state for supporting them. So I think if we look at that situation, which is never mentioned when we talk about Iran being an exporter of terrorism and Syria being an oppressive regime, we see, the black hole in the middle of this this huge universe of hypocrisy that the West lives in.
Oh, I agree, Michael, and I think most people would be surprised, maybe most listeners to this program, that as strongly as Washington supports the Israeli agenda, and they're really two rogue states in partnership, Canada is even more pro-Israeli than America
is. It's quite
is.
Amazing. When the Palestinians had the nerve to commit the terrorist act of applying for state status in the General Assembly, the United States not only threatened, well, they were going to veto it, they wouldn't allow it to happen, they immediately cut off funds to all the institutions which they were members, and Israel did the same thing, Canada did the same thing, and Israel had to pull back on those threats because it was regarded as outrageous, because there's such support for the Palestinians.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
The threats to the United States and the threats to Israel and the labeling of, I had a friend of mine who just was a survivor of this attack in Mumbai, about 4 years ago, and this friend contacted me and said, you have a sort of recourse against terrorism act in Canada where you can sue foreign countries, and we think that Pakistan was involved in this. Can you sue those countries? So I looked it up, And I looked up, there's two countries on the list of people you can sue, and they're Syria and Iran. As if those are the only countries promoting terrorism in the world and torture in the world. I mean, we know who sent Myra Rahr, the Canadian, to Syria for torture, and that was the United States. We know who's killing people in Pakistan, illegally murdering them with drones, and that's the United States. And we know who's underwriting a 45-year military occupation, denying millions of people their right to livelihood, their right to self-determination, and that's the United States and Israel.
Oh, there's no
but
question about it.
They're not on that list. You can't sue them.
Billions of dollars every year, plus weapons, plus all kinds of special benefits. Israel gets more financial help from America than all the rest of the countries in the world put together, plus all kinds of military help, and they have this literal alliance crafted in hell, and whatever Israel wants to do, it gets away with. The occupation alone is an absolute outrage. It's illegal any way you want to slice or dice it. There's no legitimacy to it whatsoever, and the fact that it's gone on all these years since 1967, besides what went on from 1948, actually before 1948. I mean, it's an absolute outrage. I have an article written, I won't get out yet, because other things are more time sensitive, but I talk about a well-known Israeli historian who justifies the fact that there wouldn't have been an Israel if Ben-Gurion didn't slaughter and displace all those Palestinians way back when. It had to be done, he claims. This guy claims to be a legitimate historian. He's a fraud.
Well, it is. It's a very wild perspective. I mean, the whole discourse on a nuclear Iran and Iran, which has been a very peaceful country, you know, only a country that's been attacked by the United States, by Iraq, by Israel. The Iran has been a very peaceful country, but the notion that a nuclear power, a crazy nuclear power like the United States, and a covert nuclear power like Israel could stand up and say the world won't tolerate a nuclear Iran is nuts. And they know that the nuclear Iran would not be an aggressive Iran. It would be one they could not dominate. They could not take out. So this is the nature of the discourse. At least it's the nature of the official discourse. I don't know if it penetrates the people, but it's the nature of the official discourse.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a big lie, capital B, capital L. There are so many big lies, and I highlight them all the time. And, of course, that's the kind of stuff you get on what I call the scoundrel media, Michael. I can't think of a better way to describe them. It doesn't matter, again, I say it on this program, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Fox News or the CBC or the BBC or the New York Times. To me, the New York Times is the worst because it has global reach. It has an awful lot of influence. Whatever gets featured on its front page, it's material that spreads around the world. You know, Fox reaches a local audience in the countries where it operates, but the New York Times has a global reach, so what they say really matters. Oh, they are my number one media target. I go at them all the time, and I know they have to know me by now because I literally hang them on their own words. I'm doing an article today where I quote them briefly. They weren't as bad today as they were at other times. There's a lot going on in Venezuela right now. Yesterday was a big day, and I wrote a number of articles. I'm doing a follow-up article today. I'll keep at it. Venezuela is a marvelous place, and Chavez is very ill, trying to recover from his fourth cancer surgery. When you get that ill, you never know what's
Chavez
going on.
I think depends on Chavez. I think the people, what he's done in that country, the institutions he's put in place, the new culture of Venezuela, I don't think that's going to disappear. Wonderful as a person as he was, and courageous and stalwart, I think it underestimates the depth of the movement. And they've always tried to do that. The Americans always tried to do that, to say that no matter how often he gets reelected, no matter how deep his policies go, to say that he's alone in this, that he's a dictator or any of that sort of thing. It's just not true.
Oh, it isn't true. And what you've been saying, I have repeated over and over again. Chavismo or Bolivarianism, it's become institutionalized in Venezuela. It's part of the Venezuelan culture. Chavez is the man who began it all, but it goes way beyond him, and whether he leads it or somebody else leads it, it's a movement. It's a spirit. It's a popular sentiment.
It's always in the interest of the big powers to demonize the opposition, to demonize them some way, to say, you know, you hear the opposition, the opposition to American imperialism in the Middle East is Islamic fundamentalism, and trying to demonize it and delegitimize it as that way, except, you know, as not as an expression, an anti-imperialist expression that takes the cultural forms that exist there, and to deny the religious fanaticism that pervades the United States and Canada and Israel and all the Western countries. So I don't know. You know, look, this all seems, these big lies seem very obvious, but, some people obviously they swallow them or they don't see an alternative. I think the problem that we face nowadays is some credible alternative. And for a long time there were alternative models, and they were crushed. There was the Eastern European model, as unappealing as it was, still made enormous inroads in the social rights and human rights of peoples around the world. The South of the Latin American movements, the movement in Cuba. The Chilean democratic movement, all these kinds of movements gave some hope for some alternative, and the problem is that they were so severely crushed, so viciously, criminally crushed by the big powers that, people need a credible alternative, and it's very hard to find one in form.
Well, it's amazing. There are so few places around, it seems, Michael, where there really is true social justice. Whether or not it's perfect is not the issue. But when you compare what's going on in a country like Venezuela to what's going on in Canada, in America, Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, et cetera, and so on and so forth, I mean, it is literally a night and day situation where in one place you've got a government that really wants people. It wants to help people, especially the ones most disadvantaged. And in all these other countries, the exact opposite is going on. The people most in need of help are the ones who are being hurt most. Russia Today had a story about what's going on in England. I mean, people are really suffering. People are going hungry. Some people say they may have to resort to stealing because they can't feed their families. And when some people get arrested for shoplifting food in Britain, they said the cops don't even arrest the cops don't even take them and put them in jail. They take them to a food bank. Hungry people are going to do that kind of stuff.
The hypocrisy is unbelievable. Now we have these austerity measures in Canada and Ontario. We have the attacks on the teachers' unions. The teachers' unions have just been, their right to collective bargaining has been abolished by the Ontario government, a Liberal government, that froze their wages and froze their and cut off their sick days. And the same government that froze welfare rates. And this government is throwing money hand over fist at its rich supporters. We had at the university, at my law school, this group, Research in Motion, the ones who made the BlackBerry. Well, this guy Jim Balsillie is a big friend of the Liberal government, and they were going to throw $50 million of taxpayers' money to give him some kind of phony think tank, some plutocratic think tank, to buy our law school from a businessman's point of view. And they were giving him all this money at the same time. They said there was no money for welfare rates, no money for teachers, no money for classrooms. They threw this public money at him. And when we rejected it, we stood up and rejected it. They said, oh, you communists up there. And we said, what? We're saving the taxpayer $50 million. So I don't know. That's the media obviously tried to distort it. But it's just the hypocrisy. There's so much money. Look at the basic point is there's millions of people wanting to work. They have the knowledge and the muscle and the brain power to work. They have the technology to work. There's work that needs to be done. Look at all these Aboriginal peoples. They live in dreck on the reserves. The housing is bad. They have nothing to do there. But there's lots to be done to build those places up, and there's lots of people wanting to do it, but they're not allowed to do it unless some fat cat rich person who inherited all his money can make a profit from it.
That's the key.
And that's a big problem. People want to work. There's work to be done, but they're not allowed to work by our crazy system that just feeds these ultra-rich people and says if they can't make a profit, then nobody gets to work.
Well, only profit
and
matters.
This is a fundamental problem. This is the center of all the starvation in the midst of unbelievable resources. I mean, Africa is a very rich country. As Michael Parenti says, it's only its people that are poor.
Well, that's right. There was another Russia. Well, profit. I mean, that's the be-all and end-all. There was another Russia Today report on today about dangerous drugs, and it focused a lot on drugs that a lot of kids have taken. It can harm them greatly. It can kill them. And the FDA, which, of course, is run by big healthcare company officials, drug companies, hospital chain CEOs or ex-CEOs or top officials, people like this. They're the ones that come in and run these agencies, and they don't give a damn about what happens to kids or adults or anybody else. The only thing that matters is their bottom line, make a buck. If people die, well, you know, that's a small price to pay. We gotta make a profit. So if we kill them with dangerous drugs, and when they have things that they need to inform the public about, they'll either downplay them or put them in print so small nobody can read it, and for the most part, they say as little as possible. A lot of people are harmed, and this was what Russia Today featured. But you can say the same thing about so much more. There was something I read that I don't know how they decide these things, but some kind of a poll that decided Monsanto was the most hated company in the world. I can think of a lot of companies that I could call the most hated for all kinds of reasons, but of course they were talking about the genetically modified foods that nobody in their right mind should eat because they are extremely dangerous. I absolutely have gotten them out of my life. I don't even eat ingredients because I'm fearful that they won't tell you that you got a GMO ingredient, but it's not listed on the label. Labeling is banned in America. They don't want you to know the poison that you're taking into your body. And Monsanto is responsible for that. Well, you know, the oil companies are doing this, and the defense companies are doing that, and Wall Street is doing everything combined. So, I mean, they're my nominee for the world's worst companies, not just one of them, all of them. All of them rolled up into a ball. My God, I wrote two books about them, Michael.
Yeah.
Those SOBs have to know something about me by now.
Yeah, well, more power to you, Stephen. You're doing a wonderful job, and I know everybody's listening and they're reading your books. And it's a puzzle to me, the disconnect between the information that is available and the structure of power we have. I guess the power, they don't call it power for nothing. I mean, these people just have some way of, notwithstanding, you know, saying black is white and night is day, and somehow getting away with it. And I think that a lot of it is because people are enthralled. You know, I was reading in Spain now, they have this tremendous, very, you know, advanced country, enormous brain power, muscle power, resources, etc. And the people have no work there. You know, people are working for nothing. They're working for their companies for nothing, and they're not getting paid. And you know why they're doing that? Because they don't want the company to go out of business. They'd rather not be paid, and the company not go out of business, and maybe they'll get paid in the future. And meanwhile, the reason the company's not going out of business is because the boss is still making a profit. So people are working, and they're afraid that, you know, that they want to protect their boss because it's the old, because now we have such a small public sector and such a huge private sector that profit making has to survive, otherwise the individual worker survives. So all they can do is think of allegiance to their own private company. And everybody's sort of, you know, as they say, making their own Shabbos and après-moi le déluge. And that's why we have this incredible lack of a civic consciousness. And I don't know, you know, we grew up, you and I, in a time when there was, things seemed to be moving in the right direction. These basic contradictions, the idea of people who didn't work forbidding other people from working because they didn't make a profit from it, that was, on the defensive. After the Second World War, that was on the defensive. There were the Roosevelt Four Freedoms. This was all on the defensive. But somehow, plutocrats, these tyrants gained the upper hand again, and money ruled again. And unfortunately, until we have a huge crisis, you can't, it seems almost impossible to, you know, in history, the only time real change has come about is when there's been a huge crisis. Now, the crisis, people, you know, there's a two-thirds, one-third society, and people can say, well, the poor people, you know, on the Jersey Shore, Katrina, the people in Flint, Michigan, the people without work, that's not me. And but once it reaches up to the, it has to go so deep when people say, no, you know, the enemy, they're not the immigrants, they're not the Islamicists. The enemy is the boss. The enemy is the guy who is obscenely wealthy and does nothing, inherit it all, and makes it all on my back, and now is not letting me work. But when will that happen?
When will it happen is right. I mean, the economic state of Western countries is so deplorable, the data is so bad that they have to be suppressed. And it's been said many times in this program, when you calculate unemployment in America alone, based on the model that was used three decades ago, before the entire process was corrupted to make things look better than they really are, to put a brave face on crisis. The real unemployment rate today is 23%. In the Great Depression, it was 25%. The economy was a lot different than it is now.
But this, even that unemployment, of course, is people who are seeking work, and they have to be actually looking for jobs, so there have to be jobs to be looked for.
Well, that's exactly right.
If you take labor force, people actually working as a percentage of labor force, that's gone way down. It's like it's off the charts.
And so many of the good jobs have literally been exported abroad. They've been offshored. High-pay, good-benefit manufacturing jobs, they're disappearing. They've been disappearing for years. They're in China. They're in Bangladesh.
Union jobs, attack on unions. You know, freedom to work. I heard this guy from Wisconsin. We're in favor of freedom. Yeah, freedom of the people with the economic power to wield it. Against people without economic power.
Well, that's right. Freedom to accept your status as neo-serfs and keep your head down. And if you don't, we'll knock it off. And that's the good old American way. And literally, it is spreading like an epidemic. And people don't understand this kind of stuff. I was interviewed yesterday, and we discussed this. The host gave me a rather long introduction, and I was very thrilled when she brought the topic up. And I said, this is such an important issue to discuss. The fact that so much harm is being done, and most people, we're talking about America, most people in America simply don't understand this. And too many of the ones who understand enough don't do anything about it. And they don't realize that if they don't take this on themselves and work to institute change to benefit themselves, their own welfare, their families, if they don't do it, it'll never be done. And the notion that you can go to the ballot box and elect A, B, or C, or whatever, well, there's only an A and a B, and A and B are really the same thing. You know, the
A1
same person,
and A2.
That's right, A1 and A2. America's duopoly, I mean, that's the power that runs America. And it really is the same in other Western countries. You know, whether parties call themselves liberal or conservative, I mean, they're basically the same on all the major issues.
They only have a very small margin of operation. They can't rock the boat. They can't unsettle the so-called investors. In other words, they can't offend or attack the rich, and that puts limits on everything they can do.
That is so true. That is so true.
And it doesn't matter who they are. And, you know, we have the NDP, we have the Social Democratic Party here, and the only way it can get the media to accept it, the only way it can sneak in is by discarding all its left-wing policies and adopting all the right-wing policies and just sort of, talking left but acting right. We had a government here in Ontario that was elected, a majority government, elected on real socialist platforms. I remember back in 1990, and this guy Bob Rae, who's now a liberal, of course, but then he was the NDP guy, they abandoned every one of their policies, just like, and they started to seek the votes of the people who voted against them. That's what they all do.
Oh,
the right
indeed.
Thing comes in and they say, okay, let's destroy everything. And we don't care because we know that when we get out of office, we're going to get a great corporate directorship, we're going to be rich.
Well, that's
but
exactly
somehow,
right.
The Social Democrats, when they get in power, they seek the votes of the people who voted against them, and they're very careful not to rock the boat.
Well, they can stay in government if they want, and they can collect their good pay and their great benefits. Or if they want, right. They can leave and take a very high paying job in industry or as a lobbyist or whatever. And one hand greases the palm of the other. They all work in they're all complicit for the same kind of things. They all screw the public royally or otherwise. And it is really an outrageous thing, and only people from their own efforts have a chance to do anything about this. Michael, we're almost at the end of the program. A final comment or two.
Well, my only comment is, again, one struggle, many fronts. Wherever you look, you see hypocrisy and lies. And it's very important to expose them. It's very important not to be taken in by the discourse that exists, because the discourse that exists is within a very safe realm. It's in a very restricted realm. And we have to sort of, what they say, think outside the box. And we can't take, the menu, they say, the menu today is take or leave it. We can't accept that menu.
Oh, we sure can.
We have to reject that menu.
Michael, I would only end by saying Gandhi said it a lot better than I ever could. But basically he said when people decide they're not going to take this crap anymore and they really determine and they fight the good fight, they're going to beat the bastards. That's exactly what happens. And the bastards know it. They hold people down because they scare them and they deceive them and they do everything else. But when people don't fall for their cons and they really fight back, they're going to win the game. It doesn't come easily. It doesn't come quickly. But the struggle can be won if it's waged with enough courage and sustaining it over the long term. Michael, my great thanks. I'll just end by reminding my listeners that, of course, we're on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We're on weekends, Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.